Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today is Wednesday, October 9th, as we head towards the weekend, and I can't wait. And but today, if you noticed, we are on Facebook today. If you want to check us out, we're on Facebook Live. Go to LA Talk Radio's page on Facebook, and you'll see us there. We have a special guest, and we also have a special co-host. And her name is Heather. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you.
Of course. And if you noticed, people in L.A., the traffic was very light today because it is a Jewish holiday. It's Yom Kippur. And it's actually the holiest day of the year for Jewish people.
That's right.
So it took me half the time to get here. It just shows you how full of Jews this town is. But I'm being Jewish myself, I feel very ashamed for not staying home and going to temple and stuff, but I couldn't really cancel all the shows we've had, you know.
Sure.
I mean, because we have about 12, 15 shows today and several last night, so I just couldn't get out of it, you know.
Well, what will you do today for it, Sam?
Nothing, really. I'm supposed to fast. I'm not fasting.
Okay.
I'm not supposed to do really anything other than go to temple, and because it's a day where you atone. It's the Day of Atonement. That's mm-hmm. what it means. And you sort of like, you make amends with God, with other people, sort of like a confession, but it's something that you can only do once a year. So, and then it's pretty serious because you're supposed to be either decided whether you're going to be written in the book of life or not for the next year. So it's kind of like... scary stuff, but
you might
want
to find a temple tonight, Sam.
I know, right? Maybe too late. I already sinned.
No.
But at any rate, we did get a benefit out of it, and it's light traffic this morning. If you want to get into the details, but thank you for joining us, everybody. As you know, I'm back from a week's break, and I'm feeling a lot better. Smoking and. I sleep better. I think I feel better and everything.
That's good.
So that's good. Yeah. One thing I didn't tell you is I quit weed also, and that's a change for me. You know, because I smoked weed for all my life, and after the doctor scared me a little bit, I decided I'm going to quit that too.
He was against the weed too.
Well, he didn't say anything about that.
He just
I didn't tell him. Yeah.
General. Okay. Oh, okay.
Smoking cigarettes. But what I did is I looked up online and I wanted to see what cannabis does in terms of a stroke.
Sure.
And apparently it does increase your chances. So I thought I'm not
really going
to play with it. And that's it for me, you know. So a lot of people are like, I mean, I'm thinking, damn it, you know, it's like all these years I smoked when it was illegal and I had to be in the closet. Now that it's legal and I'm out there, I can't smoke anymore. So that's kind of like a pain in the ass. But I got to tell you, man, I quit it all cold turkey and I'm feeling better. I never thought I would, you know.
That's
and
amazing.
People say I look better and everything. So that's okay because I know it like sucked away my energy, you know.
Yeah.
I would be tired all the time. But I liked it, you know. I mean, you get used to it, you know. And so I never thought I could go without. But when you get a scare like this, like a stroke, you don't mess around with it anymore, you
no.
know. So, yeah. Anyway, that's the story here. Heather, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm
you're,
stoked to be here.
You're a newcomer to L.A., right?
Yeah, I just moved a few months ago.
A few months ago, mm-hmm. and you told me you came from Portland, Oregon.
I did, yeah.
And is that where you grew up also?
No, so I
you
actually grew up in a little town called Port Orchard in Washington.
Oh, really? In Washington
mm-hmm.
State?
Yeah, Washington State.
I see. And so it was a little town?
Yeah, I would say, well, I mean, in comparison to the fact that I'm living in L.A. right now,
right.
a tiny little town.
Yeah, even compared to Portland, right?
Even compared to Portland,
yeah.
but bigger than my school town.
Really?
Yeah.
So you had a smaller school town?
Yeah, I went to college in a little truck stop of a place called Ellensburg, Washington.
How did you end up there?
My dad said that I should be a teacher, and they have a great education program. They also have a really good theater program, and I went there for theater arts. I did not go there for education, but after I graduated, I was teaching, so I should have gotten for education.
So you got some education, right?
Oh, yes.
Good for you.
Thank you.
And what was Portland like? How many years did you live in Portland?
About 8 years.
8 years.
Yeah.
Did you like it there?
I love Portland.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
I think the energy is awesome. The food's great.
Yeah.
If you like beer, there's a lot of beer.
A lot of beer in Portland.
Do beer,
right. Now, it also rains a lot there, right? But you were used to it coming from Washington?
Yeah. Although I just heard that they had an all-time high for rain in September, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
This past September?
Yeah. Just a month.
Oh, wow.
This month.
Yeah. Well, many of our listeners know that I was going to move to Oregon last year. And I changed plans because of business reasons and all that. But I told you, I went to Portland and I wasn't that impressed because then I went to other parts of Oregon and they were beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
It's a gorgeous state, you know, I got to admit. And I was going to move there to the coast, but it never materialized. So I'm here and I don't know about the rain. There is a lot of rain there, but also because of that, there's a lot of green.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And nature and stuff like that. And that's what I fell in love with. So I figured, you know, maybe I can handle the rain because I do love rain. I just don't know how much of it I can take, you know.
Yeah, 30 days in a row is a lot.
Right?
it is a lot.
It's like in a row, right? The sun never comes out.
The sun is there.
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Hiding behind clouds.
Oh, boy. And so you moved to Portland to be in the big city, right? To pursue your theater and things like that? Teaching?
Well, actually, I was going to move to L.A. at that time, but then I found this little overnight theater camp that was in Portland. And when I went there to work with them for a summer, I felt like I was home, and I hadn't felt like that since I left for college. So so I said, L.A.? Not yet. And I moved to Portland.
But you had set your eyes on L.A. at one point, right?
Yeah, I see.
Well, welcome to town.
Thank you.
You know, we always welcome new people because we don't have enough. We only have about 4 million people here, and we could use more. So, the traffic is kind of light, so we're looking for more cars and stuff like that. So,
yeah, that's what I've noticed.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So I always welcome everybody to town, you know. But, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And good luck to you in L.A. also. You know, it's not an easy town to live in.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Sometimes it eats people up and spits them out. But but I don't wish that on you. I know that you probably do well. Are you going to pursue teaching or theater or both? Because you have background in both, right?
Yeah, theater arts is kind of where my passion lies.
Your favorite.
And when I say kind of, I mean it takes over my life most of the time.
Really?
Cool. Yeah.
So you stay in theater? Do you look to do acting in movies too, television?
I've tried a little bit of film. It's not really my medium. I like kind of the family feel of a theater and the fact that you go through the entire story in one arc. But maybe I haven't given film enough of a chance.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
That's okay. I mean, there's plenty of work here in theater, I'm sure, you know?
Yeah.
There's a big, a lot of culture in this town, for sure.
There is. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, cool. So thank you for joining me this morning. We're going to have a lot of fun, and we're going to bring on our guest right now, who is, her name is Kim Curzon. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Hi, thank you.
Of course. Thank you for sitting patiently while we just bullshit here.
Oh, you know, my pleasure. It's
but, you know, I mean, it's part of the show here, you know. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And are you an L.A. native?
You know, I am an L.A. native. I was born in L.A., but raised mainly in Orange County.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're Southern California, though.
Yes, Southern California.
Have you been out of here at all?
Yes. I lived 15 years in Austin, Texas.
How was that?
What was that like?
It was a lot of fun.
Really?
Oh, it's a fun town. It's hot there, though, I have to tell you. Oh, my God, it's hot. But beautiful and fun, and it's a party town.
It is a college town, right?
It is a college town, and they have the greatest music, the greatest parties ever, and excellent food, and it is just a lot of fun.
Really?
Absolutely.
Good for you. What attracted you to Austin at the time?
So I'd been living in Los Angeles. I got my bachelor's degree, and I wanted to experience more of a community feel. I had visited Austin. I visited in April when the Blue Bonnets were blooming, and it was just idyllic. And then I moved there in the middle of summer and I realized it's 100 degrees and the humidity is unbelievable.
Really?
So I kind of realized what I'd gotten into on day one. Yeah. But I ended up staying there for quite a while. And then I ended up getting a master's degree and I really enjoyed it. But, you know, lured back to Los Angeles.
Yeah, eventually you come back, right?
Yeah.
How long were you in Texas for?
15 years.
15 years, yeah. That's a long time, huh?
It
is. So what did you do there?
So while I was there, I got my master's degree.
In what?
In literature and psychology.
Oh, wow.
And I got involved in the arts. I mean, everybody loves the arts. It's a community that loves creativity. So a lot of people have bands and they're working on their various art projects. They're dancers and they're visual artists. And I, you know, experimented with all kinds of creative things, just like everyone in Austin does. But I was particularly interested in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, started in on my Anna Eastman journey, actually in Los Angeles, and just continued that. But I also, while in Austin, I got involved in the film world, kind of by accident, sort of fell into it. And it's strange how these things
happen. Yeah, right?
Like you grew up in LA, went there for college, and then...
Yeah, and then by...
found film there.
Yeah,
right.
by accident, I got involved and then acted in a few movies, and co-wrote some movies.
Oh yeah, was that Before Sunset?
Before Sunrise.
Where you wrote that?
Before Sunrise and Before
Sunrise.
Sunset.
Yeah, thank
you. So I had not really expected to do those things. Wasn't expecting to be involved in the film world.
Right.
But that's what ended up happening. I wanted to be some sort of writer, and I ended up writing film there for a little bit. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
And they did pretty well.
Yeah, I was nominated for an Academy Award for writing.
Wow.
And,
when was that?
The nomination happened in 2005.
Oh, wow. Very
yeah,
cool. So you must have been very proud.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And that was for what film?
Before Sunset.
Before Sunset. Who was in the film? Do you remember?
Yeah. Yes. It was Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. And that's a sequel to Before Sunrise,
uh-huh.
which came out in 1995.
And that one you also wrote.
Yes. Oh. I co-wrote that with Richard Linklater.
Wow,
so, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So so you wrote a script for films, but did you write books also at the time?
Well, you know, it's funny. The way I got involved in this film world is that I was working on my master's thesis on Anna Eastman,
mm-hmm.
and I was interested in her psychology.
Mm.
And then in the midst of doing this, a friend of mine said, you know, they're casting for a little student film, and I think they need actors. You should go down and audition.
Right.
And I said, well, I've never done anything like that. I'm not qualified to do it. He said, oh, go down and do it. It's a little student film. It's no big deal. Just go down and audition. So I went down and auditioned, and my audition was basically just telling the director about myself. I told him about my master's thesis that I was working on, and I got a part in that film, and it was called Slacker,
uh-huh.
which ended up being a little bit of a cult film, right?
Okay.
And then based on our conversation, he kept in touch with me and wanted to read my master's thesis, and then put me in Dazed and Confused. And then
so you acted in that movie?
Yes, I was in Dazed and Confused.
Did you get to smoke some weed?
I was the teacher.
No.
I didn't get to smoke. No, I was the sort of Bolshevik teacher who did the bicentennial spiel, like scolding, you know,
really?
Telling the children to.
Now I'm going to have to rewatch the film and see you there.
Yeah, so they were the little renegades, but.
You were the straight one there, right?
Well. You know, she had a private life, that teacher did.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I need to watch
the
film
again.
She was up
to things.
I don't remember it. Yeah.
She was up to things behind the scenes, that girl.
Okay.
She was a little rebel herself. Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa. That film was done when? In the 80s? 70s? 80s?
Early 80s. So it was. Early 80s. Early 90s. And it's based on the mid 70s.
Mid 70s, exactly. But it was done later than that.
Yeah, the early 90s. It was made in, I believe it was 90, shot in 92, came out in 93.
Right. And that was at the period when I was a teenager. So I could totally relate to that film, you know? I mean, I lived in Vegas at the time between the ages of 16 and 20. And yeah, I mean, you want to talk about getting high and weed and everything. That was it. That was life. You know,
mid-70s.
Parties. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so great music and everything during that time. So so I can totally relate to this. It's about my generation, you know.
Yeah.
So I definitely need to watch it again. I don't remember much from it, but I remember it really touched.
Couldn't be the weed.
Yeah, it touched me and stuff. So, well, we're going to get to the reason why you're here. You mentioned Anaïs Nin, and I'd heard this name throughout my life, but I never knew who she was. I just, in the back of my mind, she was associated with sex,
uh-huh.
right? Uh-huh. So there was something like that in there, yeah. right? In the whole story.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us, first of all, who Anaïs Nin was.
Anaïs Nin was a diarist who, born in 1903, came to America by boat as an immigrant when she was 11 years old.
From where?
At that point, they were living in Spain.
Mm.
She's of Spanish descent. And her father had abandoned the family. And in 1914, when she was 11, she, her mother, and brothers came to the United States by boat. They came through Ellis Island. And they were immigrants. Mm. They did not speak English.
Right.
So the family was a bit devastated by the loss of this father.
Right.
While on board the boat, she started writing a letter to her father to lure him back to the family.
Right.
And that letter ended up being the very beginning of a diary that she wrote her entire life. So mm-hmm. starting at age 11 until when she died in the 1970s, she kept this amazing diary.
Wow. Like daily? She put daily stuff in there?
Well, close to it.
Close
yes,
to it.
She wrote right. regularly.
Wow. That's pretty cool, though, because you don't forget your life, right? Everything's documented and stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wish I had done that, you know?
Sometimes.
You know? And you wonder sometimes how people write autobiographies, but I guess a diary is part of that whole thing, right? I mean, you can look back and remember what you said, what people said, things like that.
She kept all of her diaries, many, many, many thousands of diary entries, stacks and stacks of books.
Wow.
And she kept them, and she considered them to be her life's work.
Mm-hmm.
So I stumbled upon her child diary when I was a college student. And at that time, I had no money at all. I had to spend all of my lunch money for the week to buy this child diary. But as I thumbed through the diary, I was standing in a bookstore in Whittier, California. And as I thumbed through this diary, I was like, this kid could really write. This is beautiful,
wow.
beautiful writing. And she's only 11 years old.
Right.
So I got addicted.
And this had been translated to English, right?
Yes. Okay. So she eventually spoke English, but those very beginning diaries were written in Spanish. She also spoke French, but they were written in Spanish. And so, yes, they were translated. But I actually later saw the diaries themselves, held the diaries, and confirmed for myself that they were that those were her actual words. She was an incredible writer. Even at age 11, she was an amazing writer who then documented her life as it rolled out through the 20th century.
Wow, very cool. So let me ask you this. Why did she become famous, and why were you attracted to this in the first place?
Well, you mentioned a minute ago that you knew she had some association with sex. That's what
right.
you're thinking of. So here's something very interesting is that at the very end of her life, when she was on her deathbed, and this was after some of her diaries had been published and edited a bit, it was presented to her that she could have published erotica that she had written in the 1940s. Now, she had never expected this erotica to be published. She was a poor artist in the 1940s, she was a starving artist. And someone had approached her and said, you know, it's maybe not that easy to find pornographic writing in the 1940s. Sure. They said, we'll pay you $1 a page to write pornographic writing from the woman's point of view. Now, she needed the money, and so she started writing and wrote as much as she could, and she wrote stories. The person who asked her to write those stories kept saying, cut out the poetry. Cut out the poetry. Please make it more graphic.
Yeah.
She couldn't
we
do
want
it.
Porn.
They wanted pornography.
Hardcore.
And she couldn't do it. She was a very poetic person. She just was so poetic. But she wrote these stories. She was paid $1 a page and kept the stories. And then on her deathbed, she agreed to have those stories published. That's why you think of the sex, because the first book of her erotica is what it's called. The first book of her erotica is Delta Venus. It was published soon after she died, and it became her most successful book, of course.
Right.
And then a book called Little Birds. But then after she died, her diaries had been published. What happened a bit after she died is that the executors of her estate started publishing all of the parts that had been edited out of her diary. So she had not wanted certain personal information included because, you know, we would all want to edit certain things out because we wouldn't want to hurt family members, wouldn't want to hurt loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She had edited out certain bits.
Right.
Those were all put back.
Oh.
And so that's why we now think of her as associated, because she told it all.
Right, everything,
Do you think
right?
that was part of what she agreed to when on her deathbed, as you say? She said, yes, include everything.
There's a tiny controversy about this.
Mm-hmm.
Her beloved second husband, Rupert Pohl, says that she agreed to have it all exposed after she died. Now, some people believe that that probably is not the case. Mm-hmm. I don't think he lied. I believe Rupert. I met Rupert and talked with Rupert before he died.
Really?
And I believe that he is telling the truth and that she did want all of her diary. But this was quite upsetting to family members who not want her personal information exposed. But it is just so fascinating. Her life is so complex and so fascinating. That I think it's an amazing thing to go on this journey of someone's private life, of all the things that we would keep to ourselves, you know, of all the feelings and the doubts and the confusion. It's there in this document that lasts most of the 20th century.
Right, right. And now, based on my math here, she was in her 30s, 40s, right? Late 30s, early 40s, when she wrote this stuff, because you said in the 40s, right? In the 1940s, she wrote this?
The erotica?
Right.
Yeah, so she was born in 1903, so she would have been, say, in her 40s when she was writing the erotica.
Right, right.
Yes.
Very interesting, you know. So now, so you wrote a book about this. You've done, obviously, a lot of research on her.
For many years.
Yeah, I mean, you devoted a lot of time to one person, and that's very interesting, you know. It's fascinating to me. And because obviously you were fascinated by her life and her writing.
It was like one breadcrumb would lead to another breadcrumb, which would lead to another breadcrumb. And so I felt like a detective uncovering all these bits. And eventually I was invited by the family to work in their home with all of her papers.
Wow.
So
how did they find out about you? Did you contact them?
I had known Rupert Pohl, her second husband, before he died, and so it was easy for me to contact them. After he died, his nephew and wife moved into the home, and they're just under a mountain of papers in that house. There's just, you just wouldn't believe. And so they are just like, what do we do with all this stuff? And so I met them, and I said, I will help go through these materials, help sort them out. I know what's important. I know what's not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can do archival work for you
in
going through her life's work and help you see what's important and what needs
to be. Yeah, I would see how they'd be interested in that. You know, that sounds... It sounds interesting to me. I mean, if somebody came to me and said, hey, I want to research your father. Okay, go ahead, you know.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah. So then you put it all together in a book called Spy in the House of Anais Nin. So when did you write the book? Is that recent?
It's a recent book. It's today is the publication date.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Like a little baby, right?
It's a little
Being
baby.
Born.
Look at it. It's a little baby. And yeah, so I've been writing chunks of it over the years, but this is now just all pulled together and just writing the final bits this past year.
I see.
So that we have the book. Yes.
Right. Amazing. Well, I mean, it was inevitable that you write a book after all this research you've done and mm-hmm. wanting to share this with the world. And then before we forget, you're going to have a book signing tomorrow, right?
Yes.
So if we managed to fascinate you so far, you can go and meet Kim tomorrow. Where?
Book Soup on Sunset Boulevard, 7 o'clock is when the party starts, and it'll go till the bookstore closes at 10.
Really?
Yes.
So you get 3 hours?
Yes.
Wow.
Sure.
And that's a classic bookstore here in L.A. It's right in the middle of Hollywood and everything, and it's... So I know a lot of famous people go there and stuff. So you're in good company there.
Thank you. Yeah. Ringo Starr was there.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. I think it was fairly recently too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember many people have done book signings there, big authors and stuff. So like I said, you'll be in good company, and congratulations, Steve,
Thank
for
you.
That. So if you guys want to find out more about Anais Nin, which sounds very fascinating based on what you're telling us, and so I guess the spy is you, right?
I'm the spy.
You're the spy. You yes. went into the house and you uncovered all this stuff.
Yeah, I'm a good spy.
Yeah?
Poker face.
Yeah,
Poker
right.
face, yeah.
So that's a lot of research, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of research. I had a lot of questions. Having read all of her diaries, everything I could find, I still had a lot of questions about her. I'm interested in people's psychology. I'm interested in character and people's psychology and what makes people tick.
Right.
And she was a fascinating and complex woman. She had an unbelievably complex life. And I think most of us do. Most of us are complicated.
Yeah. Right.
And so I was really interested in what made her tick. Mm. And so I would have a question and I would try to dig out the answer. It might take some time and some doing, but I wanted to figure out why she did what she did. She created some complications in her life that mm-hmm. were, you know, rather astounding and that most of us would keep secret. Hers are splayed out.
Like relationships and things like that? Or
100%.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So what do you mean by complicated? I mean, what, she had like a relationship along with another relationship, or what was going on there? Why is it complicated?
Well, I'd say the complications all start with that original wound of the father abandoning the family.
Mm.
That's the beginning of the whole thing. A pain starts the good and the bad. I believe this is true for most of us. It's like that grain of sand that ends up creating the pearl. Her work of art grew around that wound of the father abandoning her. It was the grain of sand that injured her. And so that diary grew around that. But also what grew around that injury was an inability to hurt people and a lust for life. She was a depressed little girl who wanted to find, she wanted to live fully. And so in her efforts to live fully, she had a very hard time dealing with the disappointments of life.
Right.
You know, like I life can be harsh and it can be disappointing and sometimes hurtful. And she desperately wanted to find happiness.
Mm.
And so because she was born in 1903, they're still under the influence of the Victorian era, mm-hmm. very conservative. She came from a conservative Spanish, a Catholic family. She started.
And then moved over to America as an immigrant, so you have that fighting against you too.
Yes, and couldn't speak English,
mm-hmm.
didn't graduate from high school. So she started questioning the way she was being raised, the way the culture worked, why she was supposed to, her only recourse was to get married. She got married at age 20 to a very nice man named Hugh Geiler,
mm-hmm.
but she found that she wasn't totally fulfilled.
And how old was he at the time?
He was 25.
Oh, okay. So it's not a big difference.
Right. No.
Okay.
No. But she
had, 'cause I thought maybe she looked for a father figure or something at the time.
No, she didn't. They were a fairly young couple, and he was a wonderful man. Mm. But she wasn't quite fulfilled and was trying to figure out, why am I not quite fulfilled? Now, he tried to make her happy, but I would say an existential depression had set in by the time she was a child, and it gave her this lust for living. She wanted desperately to live fully, and so she realized that he wasn't going to be able to do it all for her. And yet she was not supposed to go get work, because in the 1920s, that would have been kind of a black mark on him as a man.
Right.
He was a young banker, and then they moved to Paris, and it was believed that if she were to go get work, that would mean, well, he wasn't providing. Mm-hmm. He was somehow failing. So she took dance classes, she loved dance. Oh, but she wasn't supposed to go dance publicly, because that would reflect badly on her. It would embarrass the family. Of She's course. Not supposed to go on stage. So there were so many doors shut that at a young age, she started blowing those doors down.
Mm.
She was like, if these taboos are going to keep me in this cage, I'm going to start blowing down these taboos. I'm going to obliterate them, because they're doing nothing but making me unhappy. I feel trapped. And I don't believe she quite knew what it was. Like decades later, Betty Friedan called it the problem that has no name. But I think it was a bit of a feminist problem that she had. Mm-hmm. She had limited opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's like, why can't I dance on the stage? Why can't I go try to get a job? She wrote a book about the writer D.H. Lawrence, and it was an embarrassment to the family, because D.H. Lawrence had written about sex with Lady Chatterley's Lover,
mm-hmm.
and he's a wonderful writer. And she had written a wonderful book about him, modestly entitled An Unprofessional Study. So, you know, she's kind of so modest about her book. And yet it was an embarrassment to the family that she had written about D.H. Lawrence. So she started at some point blowing down the taboos one by one, questioning each and every one of them. Mm-hmm. So after she'd been married for about 6 years, 6-7 years, she met Henry Miller, the famous writer of Tropic of Cancer. Mm-hmm. Henry Miller was from Brooklyn. He was living a bit of a vagabond life in Paris. It was kind of a miracle that they met, because she was such a little lady. You know, she was a little banker's wife. And here, this kind of vagabond writer from Brooklyn is invited to her home for lunch, just thinking that he's going to get a good meal. Well, they hit it off like gangbusters. They just had a meeting of the minds. And hence we have Henry. Have you heard of the movie Henry and June?
Yes.
That is based.
I never saw it, but yeah.
It's based on her diary. So
really?
It's based on the diary of Anna Eastman, Volume 1. And then later, the expurgated parts or the edited parts were made into another book called Henry and June.
Hmm.
She met Henry, and they ignited one another as writers. She actually told him to title the book Tropic of Cancer. So he was very, very, you know, influenced by her, and she was very influenced by him, and they started having an affair.
Yeah, that's what I figured. So I was going to ask, how did the husband feel about all this? You know?
Well, the husband didn't know.
He didn't know? Even when they started it as a work type of thing? That he didn't know he was part of her life, Henry, at the time?
He knew that Henry and Anna East had a working relationship,
right.
But didn't know about the affair.
Right, right. But the working relationship didn't bother him or anything? Didn't he suspect that? I mean, you leave
at
a woman
time.
And a man, you know, working together and alone and stuff. These things happen, you know?
He idealized Anna East so much. He saw her as an angel. And she was, in many ways, a very angelic person.
Right.
But he couldn't imagine that part of her. And that was part of the problem with their marriage, is that she was a very angelic little Catholic girl. And so this other part of her personality, you know, the sensual part, the sexual part of her personality, had never really been ignited.
Right. Yeah.
Until she met Henry Miller when she was about, you know, 28 years old or so. This part of her life that she'd never discovered was, boom, you know, right. Suddenly flying.
Maybe that's why she wasn't fulfilled in her relationship, right?
Yes.
In the beginning, because
yeah, the
you said, yeah, you know, I mean, you said that she loved him, they had a good relationship, but she didn't get to express her sexuality maybe with him like she did with Henry later on, right? I mean, do you think she was like sort of like vulnerable to it?
Yes, and his story, and Hugo Geiler's story, her husband's story is interesting too. He was born at the end of the Victorian era, mm-hmm. and he had been shamed so severely as a child when he was caught playing doctor with another child, another mm-hmm. little girl. He was so severely punished right. and sent away to live with an aunt. He was so severely punished that he never quite got over it. It was so injurious
wow.
that... These were two people who were coming out of the Victorian era injured, and they had a hard time finding their sexuality. And so in their marriage, they had kind of an ideal sort of love for one another, but it didn't transcend that idea. It didn't become sexual.
Right.
So, yes, I mean, yes, they had sex, but right. it wasn't fulfilling.
Right.
And then she meets this man who has no such problem, Henry Miller. Henry Miller at the time was married to June Miller. And June Miller was a fascinating person. She was really a bohemian. She was beautiful. She was wild. She was artistic. And she was hard to control. And so he actually left June in New York, came to Paris to write. June actually sent Henry to Paris because that's where all, it's like, go to Paris because that's where everybody writes. You'll write a novel.
Yeah.
And she was just begging him, write a great novel in Paris. He eventually sent for her, and Anaïs and June met. And that was an important moment for Anaïs because she discovered another part of her personality through June. She was like, oh, it's possible not to be the angelic little woman. It's possible to be wild and free and expressive, and you know, she. So they were a real triangle.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I mean, wow. You know, if I was the husband, I'd be quite disappointed about all this. But like you said, he had been injured too. You know, and I don't think there's something much worse for a man to lose his woman to another guy. You
yeah.
know.
Well. He didn't lose her, see?
No.
So she was still around.
She could not hurt him. Because she had been hurt and abandoned by her father, she could never leave Hugo. Mm. So she stayed with Hugo her whole life, but went on to have a very complicated relationship with men. She went on to have another husband.
Uh-huh. After she got divorced, or
no, she had two husbands.
Now I understand the complicated life. She had two husbands.
You know, so as I say this, I'm imagining all the judgment coming. But I have to tell you, in my life, I've had two female friends who found out that their fathers had other families.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah. But how do you manage? I mean, usually it's people that travel, right? And then, you know, the spouse doesn't know and stuff. But how was it here? I mean, how does she do this?
She traveled.
She traveled. Or at least she told him she traveled.
She had a husband on one coast and another husband on another coast.
Oh, wow. Here in America?
Yeah, New York and Los Angeles.
Wow. Jeez.
So this was shocking for me to find as I was doing this work
mm-hmm.
because I started reading the childhood diary and the clues start building up. And I figured out at one point, my God, you know, this is really getting complicated here.
It is. And she wrote all this in her diaries.
And was perplexed by it her whole life. She could not work out the problems that were caused by her inability to leave her husband because of her, you know, the pain about her father leaving and the fact that she did love her first husband and she didn't want to hurt him.
Right.
She could never figure out how to get out of this conundrum. You know, she loved him, did not want to hurt him, but her real passions were with the West Coast husband.
Right.
Yeah.
And then she ended up hurting him more than ever. Did he find out about all this, the husband or the first husband, let's say?
She was an amazing woman. These men loved her so much. She was so lovable and so adorable. And they knew that she was a complicated person, that at the very end, there had to be some sort of, you know, acknowledgement that these two men existed because she was dying and her estate was going to have to be, you know, split up in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
So her West Coast husband, Rupert, ended up giving Hugo some of the profits from the book, and then they met at a party.
Wow.
Incredible. They shook hands.
Really?
At a party.
Well,
can I ask?
We both have been bamboozled here.
Can I ask what your book focuses on in her story?
I was interested in her psychology.
Okay.
And so the psychology for me begins with her father, and it rolls out from there. I was interested in how she, first of all, how this wound played out, how she grappled with this problem of not being able to tell the truth to her husband, of how she met this other man, how she negotiated these two relationships. It was like a trapeze she was swinging on, swinging from man to man.
Wow. She titled one of her memoirs that, didn't she?
A trapeze.
Yes.
Trapeze, yes. Wow. Yes, she did.
How do you manage all the lies, all the, you know, I mean, it's got to be like, I could never do something right. like that. How do you keep all the stories straight?
She ended up having to keep a little box where she tried to keep track, because it started to get so complicated. And she talked to therapists over and over about how do I solve the problem. She would just get ready to leave her first husband, and then she just couldn't do it because she loved him and didn't want to hurt him. Then she'd think about leaving the second one, and she just couldn't do it because she loved him and didn't want to hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
So she created this trapeze.
Right. And she ended up hurting both. In the end, right?
Well, I think they both ended up adoring her. After death, they both spoke of her in glowing, glorious terms about what an incredible woman she was.
Wow.
So they were special people themselves,
sure,
who
right.
understood the complexities of life, and they had their own complications.
Right,
sure.
right.
Now, we all do.
Yeah.
When she wrote her erotica, did any of this come into play there? Or was that before? Did she write the erotica before she met those guys? Or because I'm trying to figure out, like, what kind of what drove her to imagine all these things about erotica and sex and things like that.
She had an incredible imagination.
Really?
Yeah, she was a very much a romantic,
mm-hmm.
and she put a poetic spin on everything. She had her feelings were very vivid with her from the time she was a little girl.
Mm.
And she was a natural born writer from day one. Her writing was beautiful. So she had the imagination to create these stories. It isn't that she was necessarily reporting.
Right.
It's that she was imagining. And the erotica was poetic.
Right.
I mean, the man who paid her kept complaining, more, you know, put more pornography in it, put more pornography. She was just a very poetic person, which is why this is considered some of the very first, some of the very first female erotica, because we don't know of that much female erotica, at least while she was doing the writing. I think there's been more recently,
right.
And maybe in the later 20th century. But when she was writing and when Delta of Venus and Little Birds came out in the 70s, this was new and shocking.
Mm-hmm.
I bet.
Yeah.
So the publications that she was writing for this gentleman in the 40s, those did not get published at the time, is that
no.
right?
No, it was for...
Because it was too poetic.
Well, he was just a private collector who wanted he wanted these stories for his own personal use.
Oh, my God. Yeah, there wasn't any porn on the internet yet, so he needed his own.
No. So it was kept hidden. It was just for him.
Jeez, that's amazing. So when did it first come out? When her diaries were published and things like that?
A little bit later. So she had been trying to get her writing out in the world for many years, and it was very difficult for her to get her writing out in the world. Because she was a bit of a surrealist, and that was really not in vogue at all in the 1950s. Her writing had this kind of quality that was very European, and at this point she's living in America, so she had a little cult following. But what happened in the 1960s was that there was this kind of bubbling up of interest in the private life and the personal life and in women. Mm-hmm. You know, Betty Friedan came out with her book, I believe it was in 1962. So there was this bubbling interest in women. Her first diary, Anna Eastman, The Diary of Anna Eastman, Volume 1, was published in 1966 when she was 63 years old. So it was quite late in her life. Mm. But it was fascinating because she decided to begin that first published diary in the late 1931 when she met Henry and June, because that was such a fascinating time in her life.
Sure.
But when the book was published, the publishers didn't print many copies because they thought, no, it's a diary. You know, it's interesting in a damn diary. But when the book was published, boom, it sold out right away and there was a demand. And so they realized there's a hunger for this sort of work. A woman's personal life is of interest, and she's such a brilliant writing of her early days in her late 20s, living in Lucien, France, which is a suburb of Paris. And she wrote she touched people and spoke to people. So the first diary starts in 1966, and she wrote, she kept publishing sequentially until she died in 1977.
Wow.
And then they continued after she died, and they started filling in the sections that had been removed. Mm. So that's where you get Henry and June, and then the other chunks of her diaries that had been edited out because they were too personal, risque, errata, etc. Yeah,
amazing. Well, I'm fascinated by how fascinated you are by her. Uh-huh. And we're almost out of time. Tell people again, if you guys want to find out more, everything you ever wanted to find out, get the book Spy in the House of Anna Eastman and go see Kim tomorrow. Kim Cruzan. It's going to be again at Book Soup, right? At 7 o'clock.
Book Soup on Thursday night, which is tomorrow, and it'll be at 7 o'clock until the store closes.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is now available on Amazon, Kindle, and about available on Audible.
Probably champion some of the feminist cause as well, so I think this would be of interest to a lot of people.
Especially now.
Yeah.
Especially now, because I think that she foresaw the internet.
Right.
With our personal writing.
Yeah.
We splay out our personal lives now more than ever, right?
Right.
I believe she foresaw this.
Yeah.
And she also foresaw that women would have a voice that perhaps they didn't quite have in the 20th century. She saw this coming down the line.
Yeah.
And she saw the interest in the personal. And she believed that we shouldn't be ashamed about our personal lives, our personal feelings, our sex lives, the whole emotional realm, which, by the way, we are splaying out on the internet. She saw that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if people want to find more about you, contact you, how can they do that? Are you on social media at all or website, anything like that?
Facebook. I'm on Facebook, Kim Crizan, okay. K-R-I-Z-A-N.
Okay.
And so, yes, they can find me there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very good. Or go meet her in person tomorrow, get an autograph, and be happy.
Yes, exactly. That was her goal.
Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're
very
amazing.
Much.
Thank you. We appreciate all the work you put into this. I mean, this is obviously a year's worth of work.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
It really is.
And it's nice to finally see it published, and I congratulate you for that.
Thank you so much.
What's in the future for you? Any more Anaïs, or are you going into something else?
Oh, you know.
Have you OD'd on her?
Maybe I'll take a little break from Anaïs and go off into some other realm for a bit. But yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well,
thank you,
Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
us.
You.
You're a lot of fun. And everybody, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.